Carlucci's mood didn't improve on the flight to Australia. In Sydney, they cleared customs and transferred to an A300 Airbus. In Melbourne, Cordelia finally got to stick her head out of doors for a few minutes. The air smelled fresh. She admired the DC-3 suspended from a cable in front of the terminal. Then her companion fussed at her to get to the proper ansett gate. This time, they were seated on a 727. Cordelia was glad she wasn't trusting her bag to check luggage. Part of Marty Carlucci's gloom involved speculation that his checked bag was going to get missent to Fiji or some other improper destination. "So why didn't you carry everything on?" Cordelia had said. "There's some stuff you can't carry on." The 727 droned north, away from the coastal greenery. Cordelia had the window seat. She stared down at the apparently unending desert. She squinted, looking for roads, railroad tracks, any other sign of human intervention. Nothing. The flat, brownish-tan wasteland was dotted with cloud shadows. When word crackled over the cabin speakers that the plane was approaching Alice Springs, Cordelia realized only after she'd performed the actions that she had stowed the tray table, cinched her seatbelt, and shoved her bag back under the seat ahead. It had all become utterly automatic. The airport was busier than she'd expected. Somehow she had anticipated a single dusty runway with a galvanized tin shack beside it. A TAA flight had landed minutes before, and the terminal was crowded with people who clearly resembled tourists. "We rent the Land Rover now?" she asked Carlucci. The man was leaning impatiently over the luggage belt. "Uh-uh. We go into town. I've got us reservations at the Stewart Arms. We're both getting a good night's sleep. I don't want to be any nastier than I have to be tomorrow at the meeting. It's all set up for 3 o'clock. He added as an apparent afterthought. "The lag's going to catch up with us real fast. I suggest you get a good supper with me and we get to Alice. Then it's Betty by till 10 or 11 tomorrow morning. If we pick up the rental and get out of Alice by noon, we should hit the gap in plenty of time." "There, you son of a bitch." He grabbed his alligator case from the conveyor. "Okay, let's go." They took an ansett coach into Alice. It was half an hour into town, and the air conditioning labored hard against the baking heat outside. Cordelia stared out the window as the bus approached downtown Alice Springs. At first glance, it didn't look terribly different from a small, arid American city. Certainly Baton Rouge was more alien than this, Cordelia thought. It didn't look at all as she'd expected from seeing both versions of a town like Alice. The air transit terminal turned out to be across the street from the turn-of-the-century architecture of the Stewart Arms, a fact for which Cordelia was grateful. It was getting dark as the passengers climbed down to the pavement and claimed their bags. Cordelia glanced at her watch. The numbers meant absolutely nothing. She needed to reset to local time, and change the date as well, she reminded herself. She wasn't even sure what day of the week it was now. Her head had started to throb when she plunged into the heat that lingered even while the dark was falling. She thought longingly of being able to lie straight, stretched out on clean sheets. After she'd had a long bath, she checked that. The bath could wait until she'd slept for 20 or 30 hours, at least. "Okay, kiddo," said Carlucci. They were standing in front of the antique registration desk. "Here's your key." He paused. "Sure you wouldn't like to shave expenses for GF&G and stay in my room?" Cordelia didn't have the energy to smile wanly. "Nope," she said, taking the key from his hand. "You want to know something? You're not on this picnic just because the Fortunato bras think you're such hot shit." What was he talking about? She used enough energy to glance at him. "I've seen you around the GF&G offices. I liked what I saw. I put in the word." Cordelia sighed, aloud. "Okay," he said. "Hey, no offense. I'm Bush, too." Carlucci picked up the alligator bag. "Let's get the stuff stowed and catch supper." There was a lift out of order sign on the elevator. He turned wearily toward the staircase. "Second floor," said Carlucci. "At least that's a goddamn blessing. They passed a mimeographed poster in the stairwell advertising a band called Gondwanaland. Maybe after we eat, you want to go dancing? Even he didn't sound all that enthusiastic. Cordelia didn't bother to reply. The landing opened out into a hallway lined with dark wood trim and some unobtrusive glass cases containing Aboriginal artifacts. Cordelia glanced at the boomerangs and bull roarers. Doubtless she'd be able to work up a little more interest tomorrow. Carlucci looked at his key. The rooms are next to each other. God, I'm looking forward to bagging it. I really am dead. A door slammed open behind them. Cordelia caught a quick flash of two dark figures leaping. They were monsters. Later, she decided they must have been wearing masks. Ugly masks. Tired as she was, her reflexes still worked. She'd started to duck to the side when a stiffened forearm caught her across the chest and drove her into one of the glass cases. Glass shattered, shards sprang. Cordelia flailed her arms, trying to keep her equilibrium, as someone or something tried to grapple with her. She thought she heard Marty Carlucci screaming. Her fingers closed on something hard, the end of a boomerang, as she sensed rather than saw her assailant spin around and spring for her again. She brought the boomerang forward in a whistling arc. Instinct. All instinct. Shit, she thought. I'm going to die. The sharp edge of the boomerang sliced into the face of her attacker with the sound of a carving knife slicing into a watermelon. Outstretched fingers slapped her neck and dropped away. A body rolled to the floor. Carlucci! Cordelia turned and saw a dark figure crouched over her colleague. It straightened. Stood, started for her, and she realized it was a man. But now she had a little time. Think, she said to herself. Think, think, think. Focus. It was as though the power had been blanketed by the smothering layers of fatigue. But it was still there. She concentrated, felt the lowest level of her brain engage and strike out. Stop, goddamn you! The figure stopped, staggered. Started forward again, and fell. Cordelia knew she'd shut down everything in his autonomic system. The smell as his bowels released made it even worse. She edged around him and knelt down by Marty Carlucci. He lay on his stomach, looking upward. His head had been screwed around completely, just as it had been in the maybe dream. Slightly wall-eyed, his dead eyes stared past her. Cordelia rocked back on her heels against the wall, putting her fists to her mouth, feeling her incisors bite into the knuckles. She felt the epinephrine still prickling in her arms and legs. Every nerve seemed raw. Christ, she thought. What am I going to do? She looked both ways along the hall. There were no more attackers, no witnesses. She could call Uncle Jack in New York, or Alcala, or Redig. She could even try to find Fortunato in Japan. If the number she had was still good, she could attempt to locate Tachyon in Auckland. It came home to her. She was many thousands of miles from anyone she trusted, anyone she even knew. What am I gonna do? This time she muttered it aloud. She scrambled over to Carlucci's alligator case and clicked the catches open. The man had affected an icy calm at customs. She had no doubt there was a reason. Cordelia tore through the clothing, searching for the weapon she knew had to be there. She opened the case marked shaver and converter set. The gun was blued steel and ugly, some kind of snubbed-off, scaled-down automatic weapon. It felt reassuringly heavy in her hand. Floorboards creaked down in the stairwell. On some level, Cordelia caught the scattered words. By now, he and the bitch should both be dead. She forced herself to get up and step over Marty Carlucci's corpse. Then she ran. At the end of the hallway farthest from the main staircase, a window overlooked a fire stairs. Cordelia slid it open, softly cajoling the window when the pane momentarily stuck in the casement. She skinned through, then turned to shut the window after her. She saw shadows writhing at the other end of the hall. Cordelia ducked and scuttled crabwise to the steps down. She momentarily wished she'd grabbed her overnight bag. At least she had the passport case with the Amex card and traveler's checks in the small handbag slung around her shoulder. Cordelia realized she still had the room key clutched in her left hand. She maneuvered it in her fist so that the key thrust out from between her index and middle fingers. The steps were metal, but they were old and they creaked. Quick and stealthy, Cordelia discovered, were mutually contradictory here. She saw she was descending into an alley. The noise from the street, about 20 yards distant, was loud and boisterous. At first, she thought it sounded like a party. Then she detected undercurrents of anger and pain. The crowd noise rose. Cordelia heard the flat sounds of what she guessed were fists on flesh. Terrific, she muttered. Then it occurred to her that a riot would provide good cover for her escape. She had already started mulling contingency plans. First, stay alive. Get out of here. Then call Reddick or Alcala and let them know what had happened. They would send someone to replace Carlucci while she stayed out of sight. Wonderful. A brand new guy in a tailored suit to sign his company's name on a contract. What was so difficult about that? She could do it. But not if she was dead. With both key and gun at the ready, Cordelia eased down from the bottom step of the fire stairs and started toward the mouth of the alley. Then she froze. She knew someone was standing directly behind her. She whirled, driving her left hand forward, aiming the key at a spot she hoped would be right beneath the intruder's chin. Someone was indeed there. Strong fingers clamped around her wrist, easily soaking up all the forward momentum of her thrust. The figure pulled her forward into what little light spilled down from the Stewart arms through the stair gratings. Cordelia brought the gun up and stuck the barrel into her assailant's belly. It didn't go far. She pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. She caught a glimpse of dark eyes catching hers. The figure reached forward with its free hand and clicked something on the side of the weapon. A male voice said, "Here, little missy, you lift on the safety. Now it will work." Cordelia was too astonished to pull the trigger. "Okay, I get the point. Who are you? And can we get out of here?" "You can call me Warren." Sudden light flooded down from above them, bursting through the gratings, painting quagga stripes of illumination. Cordelia stared at the bars of light falling across the man's face. She registered the wild, curly black hair, the hooded eyes as dark as hers, the broad, flat nose, the high, sharp cheekbones, the strong lips. He was, her mama would have called him, a man of some color. He was, she also realized, the most striking man she had ever seen. Her daddy would have whipped her for that thought alone. Footsteps clattered down the fire stairs. "Now, we get out of here," Warren said, steering her toward the alley mouth. Naturally, it wasn't as easy as that. "There are men there," said Cordelia. She saw an indeterminate number of men holding what seemed to be sticks. They were waiting, silhouetted against the light from the street. "So there are." Warren grinned, and Cordelia caught the flash of white teeth. "Shoot at them, little missy." "Sounds good to me," Cordelia thought, bringing up the weapon in her right hand. When she pulled the trigger, there was a sound like ripping canvas and bullets screamed off brick. The ragged muzzle flash showed her the men in the alley were now flat in the dirt. She didn't think she had hit any of them. "Later, we worry about marksmanship," said Warren. "Now, we go." He enclosed her left hand in his right, not seeming to notice the key still in place in her fist. She wondered if they were going to jump from back to back of the prostrate men like Tarzan hopscotching crocodiles in lieu of stepping stones. They didn't go anywhere. Something akin to heat washed over her. It felt like energy flooding through Warren's fingers and into her body. The heat seared from the inside out, just like, she thought, a microwave oven. The world seemed to move sharply 2 feet to the left and then drop a foot more. The air rotated around her. The night funneled into a blazing speck centered in her chest. Then it was no longer night. Warreen and she stood on a reddish-brown plain that joined the distant sky in a far, flat horizon. There were occasional hardy-looking plants and a bit of a breeze. The wind was hot and it eddied the dust. She realized this was the same plane that had overlaid the cabin of the Air New Zealand jumbo in her nightmare between Honolulu and Auckland. Cordelia staggered slightly and Warreen caught her arm. "I've seen this place before," she said. "Will the wolf creatures come?" "Wolf creatures?" Warreen looked momentarily puzzled. "Ah, little missy, you mean the Air Moonans, the long-toothed ones from the shadows." "I guess so. Lots of teeth, run in packs. They've got rows of quills around their necks." Holding the gun loosely, Cordelia massaged the inflamed place on the back of her left hand. Warreen frowned and examined the wound. "Pierced by a quill, you're very fortunate. Their venom is usually fatal." "Maybe us gator types have natural immunity," Cordelia said, smiling wanly. Warreen looked politely puzzled. "Never mind. I guess I'm just lucky." He nodded. "Indeed so, little missy." "What's this little missy crap?" Cordelia said. "I didn't want to take time to ask back in the alley." Warreen looked startled, then grinned widely. "The European ladies seem to like it. It feeds those delicious colonial impulses, you know. Sometimes I still talk like I'm a guide." "I'm not European," said Cordelia. "I'm a Cajun. An American." "Same thing to us," Warreen continued to grin. "Yank same as a European. No difference. You're all tourists here. So what should I call you?" "Cordelia." His expression became serious as he leaned forward and took the gun from her hand. He examined it closely, gingerly working the action, then clicking the safety back on. "Scale down H&K full auto. Pretty expensive hardware, Cordelia." "Going shooting dingoes?" He gave her back the weapon. She let it dangle from her hand. "It belonged to the guy I came to Alice Springs with. He's dead." "At the hotel?" said Warreen. "The minions of the Murga Magai?" "Word was out. She was going to ice the agent of the evangelist." "Who?" "The trapdoor spider woman. Not a nice lady. She tried to kill me for years, since I was a kid." He said it matter-of-factly. Cordelia thought he still looked like a kid. "Why?" she said, involuntarily shivering. If she had any phobia, it was spiders. She coughed as the wind kicked red dust up into her face. "Started as clan vengeance. Now it's something else." Warreen seemed to reflect, then added, "She and I both have some powers. I think she feels there is space in the outback for only one such. Very short-sighted." "What kind of powers?" said Cordelia. "You're full of questions. So am I. Perhaps we can trade knowledge on our walk." "Walk?" said Cordelia a bit stupidly. Once again, events threatened to outstrip her ability to comprehend them. "Where?"
"Uluru."
"Where's that?"
"There."
Warreen pointed toward the horizon. The sun was directly overhead. Cordelia had no idea which compass direction was indicated.
"There's nothing there. Just a lot of countryside that looks like where they shot Road Warrior."
"There will be." Warreen had started walking. He was already a dozen paces away. His voice drifted back on the wind. "Shake a pretty leg, little missy." Deciding she had little choice, Cordelia followed. "Agent of the Evangelist," she muttered. "That wasn't Marty. Somebody had made a bad mistake."
"Where are we?" said Cordelia. The sky was dotted with small cumulus, but none of the cloud shadows ever seemed to shade her. She wished mightily that they did.
"The world," said Warreen.
"It's not my world."
"The desert, then."
"I know it's the desert," said Cordelia. "I can see it's the desert. I can feel it. The heat's a dead giveaway. But what desert is it?"
"It is the land of Bayami,"
said Warren. This is the great Nulaba Plain. Are you sure? Cordelia scrubbed sweat from her forehead with the strip of fabric she had carefully torn away from the hem of her Banana Republic skirt. I looked at the map on the plane all the way up from Melbourne. The distances don't make sense. Shouldn't this be the Simpson Desert? Distances are different in the Dreamtime, Warren said simply. The Dreamtime? What am I in, a Peter Weir movie? She thought. As in the myth? No myth, said her companion. We are now where reality was, is, and will be. We are in the origin of all things. Right. I am dreaming, Cordelia thought. I'm dreaming, or I'm dead, and this is the last thing my brain cells are creating before everything flares and goes black. All things in the shadow world were created here first, said Warren. Birds, creatures, grass, the ways of doing things, the taboos that must be observed. Cordelia looked around her. There was little to see. These are the originals, she said. I've only seen the copies before. He nodded vigorously. I don't see any dune buggies, she said a bit petulantly, feeling the heat. I don't see any airliners or vending machines full of ice-cold Diet Pepsi. He answered her seriously. Those are only variations. Here's where everything begins. I'm dead, she thought glumly. I'm hot, she said. I'm tired. How far do we have to walk? A distance. Warren kept striding along effortlessly. Cordelia stopped and set hands to hips. Why should I go along? If you don't, Warren said back over his shoulder, then you shall die. Oh. Cordelia started walking again, having to run a few steps in order to catch up with the man. The image she couldn't get out of her head was that of cold cans of soda, the moisture beating on the aluminum outsides. She ached to hear the click and hiss as the tabs peeled back. And the bubbles, the taste. Keep walking, said Warren. How long have we been walking? Said Cordelia. She glanced up and shaded her eyes. The sun was measurably closer to the horizon. Shadows stretched in back of Warren and her. Are you tired? Said her companion. I'm exhausted. Do you need to rest? She thought about that. Her own conclusion surprised her. No, I don't think I do. Not yet, anyway. Where was the energy coming from? She was exhausted. And yet strength seemed to rise up into her, as though she were a plant taking nourishment from the earth. This place is magical. Warren nodded matter-of-factly. Yes, it is. However, she said, I am hungry. You don't need food, but I'll see to it. Cordelia heard a sound apart from the wind and the padding of her own feet on the dusty soil. She turned and saw a brownish-gray kangaroo hopping along, easily pacing them. I'm hungry enough to eat one of those, she said. The kangaroo stared at her from huge chocolate eyes. I should hope not, it said. Cordelia closed her mouth with a click. She stared back. Warren smiled at the kangaroo and said courteously, Good afternoon, Miriam. Will we shortly find shade and water? Yes, said the kangaroo. Sadly, the hospitality is being hoarded by a cousin of the Gurungach. At least, said Warren, it's not a bunny yip. That is true, agreed the kangaroo. Will I find weapons? Beneath the tree, said the kangaroo. Good, Warren said with relief. I wouldn't relish wrestling a monster with only my hands and teeth. I wish you well, said the kangaroo. And you, it said to Cordelia. Be at peace. The creature turned at right angles to their path and bounded into the desert where it soon was lost to sight. Talking kangaroos, said Cordelia. Bunny ibs, Gurungaches. Gurungach, Warren corrected her. something of both lizard and fish. It is, of course, a monster. She was mentally fitting pieces together. And it's hogging an oasis. Spot on. Couldn't we avoid it? No matter what trail we follow, Maureen said, I think it will encounter us. He shrugged. It's just a monster. Right. Cordelia was glad she still had tight hold of the H&K Mini. The steel was hot and slippery in her hand. Just a monster, she mumbled through dry lips. Cordelia had no idea how Maureen found the pond and the tree. So far as she could tell, they followed a perfectly straight path. A dot appeared in the sunset distance. It grew as they approached it. Cordelia saw a tough-looking desert oak streaked with charcoal stripes. It seemed to have been struck by lightning more than once and looked as if it had occupied this patch of hardscrabble soil for centuries. A belt of grass surrounded the tree. A gentle slope led down to reeds and then the edge of a pool about 30 feet across. Where's the monster? Said Cordelia. Hush. Maureen strode up to the tree and began to strip. His muscles were lean and beautifully defined. His skin shimmered with sweat, glowing almost a dark blue in the dusk. When he skinned out of the jeans, Cordelia at first turned away, then decided this was not an occasion for politeness, whether false or otherwise. God, she thought, he's gorgeous. Depending on gender, her kin would have been either scandalized or triggered to a lynching impulse. Even though she had been reared to abhor such a thought, she wanted to reach and lightly touch him. This, she abruptly realized, was not like her at all. Although she was surrounded in New York by people of other colors, they still made her nervous. Maureen was engendering that reaction, yet it was vastly different in nature and intensity. She did want to touch him. Naked, Maureen neatly folded his clothes and set them in a pile beneath the tree. In turn, he picked up a variety of objects from the grass. He inspected a long club, then set it back down. Finally, he straightened with a spear in one hand, a boomerang in the other. He looked fiercely at Cordelia. I can be no more ready. She felt a chill like ice water run through her. It was a sensation both of fear and of excitement. Now what? She tried to keep her voice low and steady, but it squeaked slightly. God, she hated that. Maureen didn't have a chance to answer. He gestured toward the dark pool. Ripples had appeared on the far side. The center of those ripples seemed to be moving toward them. A few bubbles burst on the surface. The water was shrugged aside. What surveyed the couple on the bank was a figure out of a nightmare. Looks meaner than any joker I've ever seen, Cordelia thought. As it lifted more of its body from the water, she decided the creature must possess at least the mass of Bruce the shark. The frog-like mouth gaped, revealing a multitude of rust-colored teeth. It regarded the humans with slitted, bulging lizard eyes. It is equally soiled of fish and lizard, said Maureen conversationally, as though guiding a European tourist through a wild game park. He stepped forward and raised his spear. Cousin Gorengach, he called out, we would drink from the spring and rest beneath the tree. We would do this in peace. If we cannot, then I must treat you in the manner employed by Mirigan the Catman against your mighty ancestor. Gurengach hissed like a freight train bleeding its brakes. Without hesitation, it lunged forward, slamming down on the wet bank with the slap of a 10-ton eel. Maureen lightly leapt back, and the stained teeth clashed together just in front of his face. He poked Gurengach's snout with the spear. The fish lizard hissed even louder.
You are not so lithe as Mirigan, it said with the voice of a steam hose.
Gurengach jerked away as Maureen pulled loose the spear and stabbed again. This time, the pointed end jammed under the shining silver scales surrounding the monster's right eye. The creature twisted, tugging the spear loose from Maureen's fingers. The monster reared high, gazing at Maureen from 10 feet, 15, 20. The man looked up, expectant, the boomerang cocked in his right hand. The hiss was almost a sigh.
Time to die again, little cousin.
Gurringatch's bull neck flexed, dipped. Jaws gaped. This time, Cordelia remembered to click off the safety. This time, she braced herself by holding the H&K with both hands. This time, the bullets went exactly where she wished. She saw the slug stitch a line down Gurringatch's throat. She released the trigger, raised the gun, fired a quick burst at the monster's face. One of the creature's eyes burst like a balloon full of dye. It cried out in pain, green jelly sloshing down across its snout. The wounds in the neck were oozing crimson. Christmas colors, Cordelia thought. Get a grip, girl. Don't go hysterical. As Gurringatch writhed in the water, Warreen swung his arm in a short, tight arc and set the end of the boomerang into the creature's remaining eye. At this, the monster bellowed so loudly, Cordelia winced and recoiled back a step. Then Gurringatch doubled over in the water and dove. Cordelia had a quick impression of a thick, Hilla-like tail disappearing through the spray. Then the pool was quiet, small wavelets still splashing up on the banks. The ripples flattened and were gone.
He has dived into the earth, said Warreen, squatting and peering into the water. He will be gone a long time.
Cordelia put the H&K back on safety. Hands free of weapons, Warreen turned away from the pool and stood. Cordelia couldn't help herself. She stared. Warreen glanced down, then met her eyes again. With little apparent embarrassment, he said,
It is the excitement of the contest.
Then he smiled and said,
This wouldn't happen under ordinary circumstances if I were guiding a European lady in the outback.
It occurred to Cordelia to pick up his folded clothing and hold it out to him. With dignity, Warreen accepted the garments. Before turning away to dress, he said,
If you're ready, it would be a good time for a refreshing drink and some rest. I'm sorry I'm a bit short of tea.
Cordelia said, I'll manage. The desert was slow to cool with the sunset. Cordelia continued to feel the heat rise out of the ground beneath her. Warreen and she lay back against the gnarled, semi-exposed roots of the tree. The air felt as though it were a quilted comforter pulled up over her face. When she moved, the motion seemed to be at half speed. The water was delicious, she said, but I'm still hungry.
Your hunger here is an illusion.
Then I'll fantasize a pizza. Warreen said.
Very well.
With a sigh, he raised himself to his knees and ran his fingers over the rough bark of the tree. When he found a loose patch, he tugged it away from the trunk. His right hand darted forward, fingers scrambling to catch something Cordelia couldn't see. Here. He displayed his find to her. Her first impression was of something snake-like and squirming. She saw the pasty color, the segments, and the many legs.
What is that? She said.
Witchetty grub. Warreen smiled. It's one of our national cuisines. He thrust his hand forward like a mischievous little boy.
Does it turn your stomach, little missy?
God damn it, no, she said with a flash of anger.
Don't call me that.
What are you doing? She said to herself as she reached for the creature.
Do I have to eat it live?
No, it is not necessary. He turned and cracked the creature against the desert oak. The witchetty grub convulsed once and ceased struggling. Forcing herself just to do it and not think about the act, she took the witchetty, popped it into her mouth, and started chewing. God, she thought, why do I do these things?
How do you find it?
Said Warreen with a solemn face. Well, said Cordelia, swallowing, it doesn't taste like chicken. The stars came out, spangling a belt across the entire sky. Cordelia lay with fingers plaited behind her head. She realized she had lived in Manhattan for close to a year and never looked for the stars at all.
Norandari is up there, said Warreen, pointing at the sky, along with his two young wives, placed there by Napelli,
the ruler of the heavens, after the women ate the forbidden food.
Apples? Said Cordelia.
Fish. To carry. A delicacy given only to the men. His hand moved, the fingers pointing again.
There, farther on, you can make out the seven sisters.
And there is Carambal, their pursuer.
You call him Aldebaran.
Cordelia said, I have a lot of questions.
Warren paused. Not about the stars.
Not about the stars.
What then?
All of this. She sat up and spread her arms to the night.
How am I here?
I brought you.
I know, but how?
Warren hesitated for a long time. Then he said,
I am of Aranda blood, but was not raised within the tribe.
Do you know of the urban aborigines?
Like in the last wave,
Cordelia said. I saw the fringe dwellers, too. There aren't really tribal aborigines in the cities, right? Just sort of like individuals?
Warren laughed. You compare almost everything to the cinema. That is likening everything to the shadow world. Do you know anything of reality?
I think so. In this place, she wasn't so sure, but she wasn't about to admit it.
My parents sought work in Melbourne, Warren said. I was born in the outback, but cannot recall any of that. I was a boy in the city. He laughed bitterly. My walkabout seemed destined to lead me only among drunken diggers, chundering in the gutter.
Cordelia, listening raptly, said nothing.
When I was an infant, I nearly died of a fever. Nothing the weirnin, the medicine man, could do helped. My parents, despairing, were ready to take me to the white doctor. Then the fever broke. The weirnin shook his medicine stick over me, looked into my eyes, and told my parents I would live and do great things.
Warren paused again.
The other children in the town had taken ill with the same sort of fever. All of them died. My parents told me their bodies shriveled or twisted or turned into unspeakable things, but they all died. Only I survived. The other parents hated me and hated my parents for bearing me. So we lived.
He fell silent. It dawned in Cordelia's mind like a star rising.
The wildcard virus.
I know of it, said Warren. I think you are right. My childhood was as normal as my parents could make it until I grew the hair of an adult. Then, his voice trailed off.
Yes, Cordelia said eagerly.
As a man, I found I could enter the dream time at will. I could explore the land of my ancestors. I could even take others with me.
Then this truly is the dream time. It isn't some kind of shared illusion.
He turned on his side and looked at her. Warren's eyes were only about 18 inches from hers. His gaze was something she could feel in the pit of her stomach.
There's nothing more real. The thing that happened to me on the airplane, the Irmunins.
There are others from the shadow world who can enter the dream time. One is Murga Magai, whose totem is the trapdoor spider. But there is something wrong with her. You would call her psychotic. To me, she is an evil one, even though she claims kinship with the people.
Why did she kill Carlucci? Why try to kill me?
Murga Magai hates European holy men, especially the American who comes from the sky. His name is Leo Barnett.
Fire breather, said Cordelia. He is a TV preacher.
He would save our souls. In doing so, he will destroy us all, as kin and as individuals. No more tribes.
Barnett, Cordelia breathed. Marty wasn't one of his people.
Europeans look much like one another. It doesn't matter that he didn't work for the man from the sky.
Warren regarded her sharply,
Aren't you here for the same purpose?
Cordelia ignored that.
But how did I survive the Irmunans?
I believe Murga Magai underestimated your own power.
He hesitated. And possibly, was it your time of the moon?
Most monsters will not touch a woman who bleeds.
Cordelia nodded. She began to be very sorry her period had ended in Auckland.
I guess I'll have to depend on the H&K.
After a time, she said, Warren, how old are you?
19.
He hesitated.
And you?
Going on 18.
They both were quiet. A very mature 19, Cordelia thought. He wasn't like any of the boys she remembered at home in Louisiana, or in Manhattan either. Cordelia felt a chill plummeting both in the desert air and inside her mind. She knew the coldness growing within her was because she now had time to think about her situation. Not just thousands of miles from home and among strangers, but also not even in her own world.
Warren, do you have a girlfriend?
I am alone here.
No, you're not.
Her voice didn't squeak. Thank God.
Will you hold me?
Time stretched out. Then Warren moved close and clumsily put his arms around her. She accidentally elbowed him in the eye before they both were comfortable. Cordelia greedily absorbed the warmth of his body, her face tucked against his. Her fingers wound through the surprising softness of his hair. They kissed. Cordelia knew her parents would kill her if they knew what she was doing with this black man. First, of course, they would have lynched Warren. She surprised herself. It was no different touching him than it had been touching anyone else she'd liked. There hadn't been many. Warren felt much better than any of them. She kissed him many times more. He did the same to her. The night chill deepened and their breathing pulsed faster. Warren, she finally said, gasping, do you want to make love? He seemed to go away from her, even though he was still there in her arms.
I shouldn't.
She guessed at something.
Are you a virgin?
Yes, and you?
I'm from Louisiana. She covered his mouth with hers.
Warren is only my boy's name. My true name is Wayangare.
What does that mean?
He who returns to the stars.
The moment came when she raised herself to take him and felt Wayangare driving deep within her. Much later, she realized she hadn't thought of her mama and what her family would think. Not even once. The giant first appeared as the smallest nub on the horizon.
That's where we're going? Said Cordelia. Uluru?
The place of greatest magic. The morning sun rose high as they walked. The heat was no less pressing than it had been the previous day. Cordelia tried to ignore her thirst. Her legs ached, but it was not from trudging. She welcomed the feeling. Various creatures of the outback sunned themselves by the path and inspected the humans as they passed. An emu, a frilled lizard, a tortoise, a black snake, a wombat. Wayangari acknowledged the presence of each with a courteous greeting.
Kozindinuin, to the emu. Mungungali, to the lizard. Good morning, Wayembe, to the tortoise, and so on.
A bat circled them three times, squeaked a greeting, and flew off. Wayangari waved politely.
Sorrow and safety, Brother Narendon.
His greeting to the wombat was particularly effusive. He was my boy Totem, he explained to Cordelia.
Warren.
They encountered a crocodile sunning itself beside their trail.
He is your cousin as well, said Wayangare.
He told her what to say.
Good morning, Cousin Curia, said Cordelia.
The reptile stared back at her, moving not an inch in the baking heat. Then it opened its jaws and hissed. Rows of white teeth flashed in the sun.
A fortunate sign, said Wayangare. The Coria is your guardian.
As Uluru grew in the distance,
Fewer were the creatures that came to the path to look upon the humans. Cordelia realized with a start that for an hour or more she had been dwelling within her own thoughts. She glanced aside at Wayangare.
How was it that you were in the alley at just the right time to help me?
I was guided by Bayami, the Great Spirit.
Not good enough.
It was sort of a corroboree that night. A get-together with a purpose.
Like a rally?
He nodded. My people don't usually engage in such things. Sometimes we have to use European ways.
What was it about?
Cordelia shaded her eyes and squinted into the distance.
Uluru had grown to the size of a fist.
Wayangare also narrowed his eyes at Uluru. Somehow, he seemed to be gazing much farther.
We are going to drive the Europeans out of our lands. Especially, we are not going to allow the men who preach to seize further footholds.
I don't think that's going to be very easy. Aren't the Aussies pretty well entrenched?
Wayangare shrugged.
Have you no faith, little missy?
Just because we are outnumbered 40 or 50 to 1, own no tanks or planes, and know that few care about our cause.
Just because we are our own worst enemies when it comes to organizing ourselves?
His voice sounded angry.
Our way of life has stretched unbroken for 60,000 years. How long has your culture existed?
Cordelia started to say something placating. The young man rushed on.
We find it hard to organize effectively in the manner of the Maori in New Zealand.
They are great clans. We are small tribes. He smiled humorlessly.
You might say the Maori resemble your aces.
We are like the Jokers.
The Jokers can organize. There are people of conscience who help them.
We will not need help from Europeans. The winds are rising all around the world, just as they are here in the outback. Look at the Indian homeland that is being carved with machetes and bayonets from the American jungle. Consider Africa, Asia, every continent where revolution lives.
His voice lifted.
It's time, Cordelia. Even the White Christ recognizes the turning of the great wheel that will groan and move again in little more than a decade. The fires already burn, even if your people do not yet feel the heat.
Do I know him? Thought Cordelia.
She knew she did not. She had suspected none of this, but within her heart she recognized the truth of what he said, and she did not fear him.
Murga Mugai and I are not the only children of the fever, said Wayangare. There are others. There will be many more, I fear.
It will cause a difference here. We will make a difference.
Cordelia nodded slightly.
The whole world is aflame. All of us are burning. Do your Dr. Tachyon and Senator Hartman and their entire party of touring Europeans know this?
His black eyes stared directly into hers.
Do they truly know what is happening outside their limited sight in America?
Cordelia said nothing. No, she thought. Probably not.
I expect they don't.
Then that is the message you must bear them, said Wayangare.
I've seen pictures, said Cordelia. This is Ayers Rock.
It is Uluru, said Wayangare.
They stared up at the gigantic reddish sandstone monolith.
It's the biggest single rock in the world, said Cordelia. 1,300 feet up to the top and several miles across.
It is the place of magic.
The markings on the side, she said. They look like the cross-section of a brain.
Only to you. To me, they are the markings on the chest of a warrior.
Cordelia looked around.
There should be hundreds of tourists here.
In the shadow world, there are. Here, they would be fodder for Murga Mugai.
Cordelia was incredulous.
She eats people?
She eats anyone.
God, I hate spiders.
She stopped looking up the cliff. Her neck was getting a crick.
We have to climb this?
There's a slightly gentler trail.
He indicated they should walk farther along the base of Uluru.
Cordelia found the sheer mass of the rock astonishing. And something more.
She felt an awe that large stones did not ordinarily kindle. It's got to be magic, she thought. After a 20-minute hike, Wayangare said, "Here." He reached down. There was another cache of weapons. He picked up a spear, a club, Nula Nula, he called it, a flint knife, a boomerang. "Handy," Cordelia said. "Magic." With a leather strap, Wayangare tied the weapons together. He shouldered the packet and pointed toward the summit of Uluru. "Next up." To Cordelia, the proposed climb looked no easier than it had at the first sight. "You're sure?" He gestured at her handbag and the H&K. "You should leave those." She shook her head, surveying first his weapons, then hers. "No way." Cordelia lay flat on her belly, peering up the rocky slope. Then she looked down. "I shouldn't have done that," she thought. It might only have been a few hundred yards, but it was like leaning over an empty elevator shaft. She scrambled for a purchase. The H&K in her left hand didn't help. "Just let it go," said Wayangare, reaching back to secure her free hand. "We might need it. Its power will be slight against the Mergamagai. I'll risk it. When it comes to making magic, I need all the help I can get." She was out of breath. "You're sure this is the easiest ascent?" "It is the only one. In the Shadow World, there's a heavy chain fixed to the rock for the first third of this journey. It is an affront to Uluru. Tourists use it to pull themselves up." "I'd settle for the affront," said Cordelia. "How much farther?" "Maybe an hour, maybe less. It depends whether Mergamagai decides to hurl boulders down upon us." "Oh," she considered that. "Think there's a good chance?" "She knows we are coming. It depends on her mood." "I hope she doesn't have PMS. "Monsters don't bleed," said Wayangare seriously. They reached the broad, irregular top of Uluru and sat on a flat stone to rest. "Where is she?" said Cordelia. "If we don't find her, she'll find us. Are you in a hurry?" "No." Cordelia looked around apprehensively. "What about the Irmunans?" "You killed them all on the Shadow Plain. There's not an endless supply of such creatures." "Oh, God," thought Cordelia. "I killed off an endangered species." She wanted to giggle. "Got your breath?" She groaned and got up from the slab. Wayangare was already up, his face angled at the sky, gauging the temperature and the wind. It was a great deal cooler on top of the rock than it had been on the desert floor. "It is a good day to die," he said. "You've seen too many movies, too." Wayangare grinned. They trudged along nearly the entire diameter of the top of Uluru before coming to a wide, flat area about 100 yards across. A sandstone cliff fell away to the desert only a few yards beyond. "This looks promising," said Wayangare. The surface of the scoured sandstone was not completely bare. Football-sized bits of rock were littered about like grains of sand. "We are very close." The voice seemed to come from everywhere around them. The words grated like two chunks of sandstone rubbing together. "This is my home." "It is not your home," said Wayangare. "Uluru is home to us all." "You have intruded." Cordelia looked around apprehensively, seeing nothing other than rock and a few sparse bushes. "And we'll die." Across the rocky clearing, a sheet of sandstone about 10 feet across flipped over, slamming into the surface of Uluru and shattering. Bits of stone sprayed across the area, and Cordelia reflexively stepped back. Wayangare did not move. Mergamagai, the trapdoor spider woman, heaved herself up out of her hole and scrabbled into the open air. For Cordelia, it was like suddenly leaping into her worst nightmares. There were big spiders at home in the bayous, but nothing of this magnitude. Mergamagai's body was dark brown and shaggy, the size of a Volkswagen. the bulbous body balanced, swaying on 8 articulated legs. All her limbs were tufted with spiky brown hair. Glittering, faceted eyes surveyed the human interlopers. A mouth opened wide, papillae moving gently, a clear, viscid liquid dripping down to the sandstone. Mandibles twitched apart. "Oh, my God," Cordelia said, wanting to take another step backward. Many more steps. She wished to wake up from this dream. Murga Magai moved toward them, legs shimmering as they seemed to slip momentarily in and out of phase with reality. To Cordelia, it was like watching well-done stop-motion photography. "Whatever else she is," said Wayangare, "Murga Magai is a creature of grace and balance. It is her vanity." He unslung the packet of weapons, unwinding the leather strap.
"Your flesh will make a fine lunch, cousins," came the abrasive voice.
"You're no relation of mine," said Cordelia. Wayangare hefted the boomerang as though considering an experiment, then fluidly hurled it toward Murga Magai. The honed wooden edge caressed the stiff hairs on top of the spider creature's abdomen and sighed away into the open sky. The weapon swung around and started to return, but didn't have sufficient altitude to clear the rock. Cordelia heard the boomerang shatter on the stone below Uluru's rim.
"Bad fortune," said Murga Magai.
She laughed, an oily, sticky sound.
"Why, cousin," said Wayangare, "why do you do any of this?"
"Silly boy," said Murga Magai, "you've lost hold of tradition. It will be the death of you, if not the death of our people. You are so wrong. I must remedy this."
Apparently, in no hurry to eat, she slowly closed the distance between them. Her legs continued to strobe. It was dizzying to watch.
"My appetite for Europeans is growing," she said. "I will enjoy today's varied feast."
"I will have only one chance," Wayangare said in a low voice. "If it doesn't work..."
"It will," said Cordelia. She stepped even with him and touched his arm.
"Laissez le bon temps rouler."
Wayangare glanced at her. "Let the good times roll. My daddy's favorite line." Murga Magai leapt. The spider creature descended over them like a wind-torn umbrella with spare, bent struts flexing. Wayangare jammed the butt of the spear into the unyielding sandstone and lifted the fire-hardened head toward the body of the monster. Murga Magai cried out in rage and triumph. The spearhead glanced off one mandible and broke. The supple shaft of the spear at first bent, then cracked into splinters like the shattering of a spine. The spider creature was so close, Cordelia could see the abdomen pulse. She could smell a dark, acrid odor. "Now we're in trouble," she thought. Both Wayangare and she scrambled backward, attempting to avoid the seeking legs and clashing mandibles. The Nulla Nulla skittered across the sandstone. Cordelia scooped up the flint knife. It was suddenly like watching everything in slow motion. One of Murga Magai's hairy forelegs lashed out toward Wayangare. The tip fell across the man's chest, just below his heart. The force of the blow hurled him backward. Wayangari's body tumbled across the stone clearing like one of the limp rag dolls Cordelia had played with as a girl. And just as lifeless.
"No!"
Cordelia screamed. She ran to Wayangare, knelt beside him, felt for the pulse in his throat. Nothing. He was not breathing. His eyes stared blindly toward the empty sky. She cradled the man's body for just a moment, realizing that the spider creature was patiently regarding them from 20 yards away.
"You are next, imperfect cousin,"
came the ground-out words.
"You are brave, but I don't think you can help the cause of my people any more than the wombat."
Murga Magai started forward. Cordelia realized she was still clinging to the gun. She aimed the H&K Mini at the spider creature and squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened. She clicked the safety on, then off again. Pulled the trigger. Nothing. Damn. It was finally empty. Focus, she thought. She stared at Murga Magai's eyes and willed the creature to die. The power was still there within her. She could feel it. She strained, but nothing happened. She was helpless. Murga Magai was not even slowed. Evidently, the reptile level had nothing to say to spiders. The spider thing rushed toward her like a graceful eight-legged express train. Cordelia knew there was nothing left to do, except the one thing she dreaded most. She wondered if the image in her mind would be the last thing she would ever know. It was the memory of an old cartoon showing Fay Wray in the fist of King Kong on the side of the Empire State Building. A man in a biplane was calling out to the woman, "Trip him, Fay! Trip him!" Cordelia summoned all the hysterical strength left within her and hurled the empty H&K at Murga Magai's head. The weapon hit one faceted eye and the monster shied slightly. She leapt forward, wrapping arms and legs around one of the pistoning spider creature's forelegs. The monster stumbled, started to recover, but then Cordelia jammed the flint knife into a leg joint. The extremity folded and momentum took over. The spider thing was a ball of flailing legs rolling along with Cordelia clinging to one hairy limb. The woman had a chaotic glimpse of the desert floor looming ahead and below her. She let go, hit the stone, rolled, grabbed an outcropping, and stopped. Murga Magai was propelled out into open space. To Cordelia, the monster seemed to hang there for a moment, suspended like the coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons. Then the spider creature plummeted. Cordelia watched the flailing, struggling thing diminish. A screech like nails on chalkboard trailed after. Finally, all she could see was what looked like a black stain at the foot of Uluru. She could imagine only too well the shattered remains with the legs splayed out. "You deserved it," she said aloud. "Bitch." "Wayangare," she turned and limped back to his body. He was still dead. For a moment, Cordelia allowed herself the luxury of angry tears. Then she realized she had her own magic. "It's only been a minute," she said, as if praying. "Not longer, not long at all. Only a minute." She bent close to Wayangare and concentrated. She felt the power draining out of her mind and floating down around the man, insulating the cold flesh. The thought had been a revelation. In the past, she had tried only to shut autonomic nervous systems down. She had never tried to start one up. It had never occurred to her. Jack's words seemed to echo from 8,000 miles away. "You can use it for life, too." The energy flowed, the slightest heartbeat, the faintest breath. Another. Wayangare began to breathe. He groaned. "Thank God," thought Cordelia, "or Bayame." She glanced around self-consciously at the top of Uluru. Wayangare opened his eyes. "Thank you," he said faintly but distinctly. The riot swirled past them. Police clubs swung. Aboriginal heads cracked. "Bloody hell," said Wayangare. "You'd think this was bloody Queensland." He seemed restrained from joining the fray only by Cordelia's presence. Cordelia reeled back against the alley wall. "You've brought me back to Alice?" Wayangare nodded. "This is the same night?"
"All the distances are different in the dream time," said Wayangare. "Time as well as space."
"I'm grateful." The noise of angry shouts, screams, sirens was deafening.
"Now what?" said the young man.
"A night's sleep. In the morning, I'll rent a Land Rover. Then I'll drive to Mighty Gap." She pondered a question.
"Will you stay with me?"
"Tonight?" Wayangare hesitated as well.
"Yes, I'll stay with you."
"You're not as bad as the preacher from the sky, but I must find a way to talk you out of what you want to do with the satellite station." Cordelia started to relax just a little.
"Of course," said Wayangare, glancing around. "You'll have to sneak me into your room."
Cordelia shook her head. "It's like high school again," she thought. She put her arm around the man beside her. There were so many things she needed to tell people. The road south to Mahdi Gap stretched ahead. She still hadn't decided whether she was going to call New York first.
"There is one thing," said Wayangare. She glanced at him questioningly.
"It has always been the custom," he said slowly, "for European men to use their aboriginal mistresses and then abandon them."
Cordelia looked him in the eye. "I am not a European man," she said. Wayangare smiled.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. March 14th, Hong Kong. I've been feeling better of late, I'm pleased to say. Perhaps it was our brief sojourn in Australia and New Zealand, coming close upon the heels of Singapore and Jakarta. Sydney seemed almost like home, and I was strangely taken with Auckland and the comparative prosperity and cleanliness of its little toy Joker town. Aside from a distressing tendency to call themselves uglies, an even more offensive term than joker, my Kiwi brethren seemed to live as decently as any jokers anywhere. I was even able to purchase a week-old copy of the Jokertown Cry at my hotel. It did my soul good to read the news of home, even though too many of the headlines seemed to be concerned with a gang war being fought in our streets. Hong Kong has its Jokertown, too, as relentlessly mercantile as the rest of the city. I understand that mainland China dumps most of its jokers here in the Crown Colony. In fact, a delegation of leading joker merchants have invited Chrysalis and me to lunch with them tomorrow and discuss possible commercial ties between jokers in Hong Kong and New York City. I'm looking forward to it. Frankly, it will be good to get away from my fellow delegates for a few hours. The mood aboard the stacked deck is testy at best at present, chiefly thanks to Thomas Downs and his rather overdeveloped journalistic instincts. Our mail caught up with us in Christchurch just as we were taking off for Hong Kong, and the packet included advance copies of the latest issue of Aces. Digger went up and down the aisles after we were airborne, distributing complimentary copies, as is his wont. He ought to have read them first. He and his execrable magazine hit a new low this time out, I'm afraid. The issue features his cover story of Peregrine's pregnancy. I was amused to note that the magazine obviously feels that Perry's baby is the big news of the trip, since they devoted twice as much space to it as they have to any of Digger's previous stories, even the hideous incident in Syria. Though perhaps that was only to justify the glossy 4-page photo spread of Peregrine, past and present, in various costumes and states of undress. The whispers about her pregnancy started as early as India and were officially confirmed while we were in Thailand, so Digger could hardly be blamed for filing a story. It's just the sort of thing that Aces thrives on. Unfortunately for his own health and our sense of camaraderie aboard the stacked deck, Digger clearly did not agree with Perry that her delicate condition was a private matter. Digger dug too far. The cover asks, "Who fathered Perry's baby?" Inside, the piece opens with a double-page spread illustrated by an artist's conception of Peregrine holding an infant in her arms, except that the child is a black silhouette with a question mark instead of a face. "Daddy's an ace," Tachyon says, reads the subhead, leading into a much larger orange banner that claims, "Friends beg her to abort monstrous joker baby." Gossip has it, the Digger plied Tachyon with brandy while the two of them were inspecting the raunchier side of Singapore's nightlife, managing to elicit a few choice indiscretions. He did not get the name of the father of Peregrine's baby, but once drunk enough, Tachyon displayed no reticence in sounding off about all the reasons why he believes Peregrine ought to abort this child, the foremost of which is the 9% chance that the baby will be born a joker. I confess that reading the story filled me with a cold rage and made me doubly glad that Dr. Tachyon is not my personal physician. It is at moments such as this that I find myself wondering how Tachyon can possibly pretend to be my friend or the friend of any Joker. In vino veritas, they say. Tachyon's comments make it quite clear that he thinks abortion is the only choice for any woman in Peregrine's position. The Tachyzians abhor deformity, and customarily cull, such a polite word, their own deformed children, very few in number, since they have not yet been blessed with the virus that they so generously decided to share with Earth shortly after birth. Call me oversensitive, if you will, but the clear implication of what Tachyon is saying is that death is preferable to Jokerhood, that it is better that this child never live at all than live the life of a Joker. When I set the magazine aside, I was so livid that I knew I could not possibly speak to Tachyon himself in any rational manner. So I got up and went back to the press compartment to give Downs a piece of my mind. At the very least, I wanted to point out rather forcefully that it was grammatically permissible to omit the adjective monstrous before the phrase Joker baby, though clearly the copy editors at Aces feel it compulsory. Digger saw me coming, however, and met me halfway. I've managed to raise his consciousness at least enough so that he knew how upset I'd be, because he started right in with excuses. "Hey, I just wrote the article," he began. "They do the headlines back in New York. That, and the art, I've got no control over. Look, yes, next time I'll talk to them." He never had a chance to finish whatever promise he was about to make, because just then Josh McCoy stepped up behind him and tapped him on the shoulder with a rolled-up copy of Aces. When Downs turned around, McCoy started swinging. The first punch broke Digger's nose with a sickening noise that made me feel rather faint. McCoy went on to split Digger's lips and loosen a few teeth. I grabbed McCoy with my arms and wrapped my trunk around his neck to try to hold him still, but he was crazy strong with rage and brushed me off easily, I'm afraid. I've never been the physical sort, and in my present condition, I fear that I'm pitifully weak. Fortunately, Billy Ray came along in time to break them up before McCoy could do serious damage. Digger spent the rest of the flight back in the rear of the plane, stoked up with painkillers. He managed to offend Billy Ray as well by dripping blood on the front of his white Carnifex costume. Billy is nothing if not obsessive about his appearance. And as he kept telling us, "Those fucking bloodstains don't come out." McCoy went up front, where he helped Hiram Mistral and Mr. Jai Warden to console Perry, who was considerably upset by the story. While McCoy was assaulting Digger in the rear of the plane, she was tearing into Dr. Tachyon up front. Their confrontation was less physical but equally dramatic, Howard tells me. Tachyon kept apologizing over and over again, but no amount of apology seemed to stay Peregrine's fury. Howard says it was a good thing that her talents were packed away safely with the luggage. Tachyon finished out the flight alone in the first-class lounge with a bottle of Remy Martin and the forlorn look of a puppy dog who's just piddled on the Persian rug. If I had been a crueler man, I might have gone upstairs and explained my own grievances to him, but I found that I did not have the heart. I find that very curious, but there is something about Dr. Tachyon that makes it difficult to stay angry with him for very long, no matter how insensitive and egregious his behavior. No matter. I am looking forward to this part of the trip. From Hong Kong, we travel to the mainland. Canton and Shanghai and Peking and other stops equally exotic. I plan to walk upon the Great Wall and see the Forbidden City. During World War II, I'd chosen to serve in the Navy in hopes of seeing the world, and the Far East always had a special glamour for me. But I wound up assigned to a desk in Bayonne, New Jersey. Mary and I were going to make up for that afterward, when the baby was a little older, and we had a little more in the way of financial security. Well, we made our plans, and meanwhile the Dickesians made theirs. Over the years, China came to represent all the things I'd never done, all the far places I meant to visit and never did, my own personal Jolson story. And now, it looms on my horizon at last. It's enough to make one believe the end is truly near.